Christopher Harmer would later remark, "Thank God for Tar, I say. He gave us all our heads and encouraged us. And, if we were doing something stupid, he pulled us up by tact and persuasion rather than by direction." Tar Robertson was a born leader, according to Masterman, gifted with independent judgment. But he was also a firm believer in mixing business with pleasure. Indeed, he saw no distinction between the two, and was a devotee of the three-hour lunch. Rank counted for little. Robertson was a major and would end the war as a lieutenant colonel, but most had no military rank at all. Yet beneath the public school banter, the puns and badinage ran deep veins of anxiety in a community cauterized by secrecy and suffused with uncertainty. Every case officer was acutely aware that a single slip could bring the entire project crashing down, with catastrophic consequences. Most secret sources showed that the Germans were constantly assessing and reassessing their agents, trusting them and doubting them, and those judgments in turn had to be evaluated and re-evaluated by Section B1A, prompting Tar to remark, "In this game one never knew quite how things would appear to the opposition, although one did one's best to guess." The Germans, he reasoned, must assume that some of their agents had been intercepted, and would surely suspect that at least some of these were working as double agents. Perhaps that suspicion could be used to advantage. If a double agent was run in an obviously bogus fashion, the Germans might assume general incompetence on the part of the British and therefore overlook the real double agents. Alphonse Timmermann, a Belgian ship steward, was arrested as a spy in early 1941 but declined to cooperate. While Timmermann, codenamed Scruffy, languished in prison, B1A began sending secret ink letters in his name to his German handler. These contained a number of glaring errors to indicate that Timmermann was being controlled. It was a brilliant plan, typical of the lateral thinking beloved of the double-cross team, and it failed utterly. The Germans never spotted the deliberate mistakes and seemed unable to realize that Scruffy was obviously controlled. This unshakable faith in their spy was confirmed by most secret sources. The Scruffy case was terminated. This was a disappointment for B1A, but far more so for Alphonse Timmermann, who was executed. The Abwehr even failed to spot his death notice in the Times. Slowly, it began to dawn on Tar Robertson that the Abwehr really might be as gullible as it seemed. Yet Tar remained convinced that other spies must be at large in Britain, perhaps even working within MI5. And he was right. In February 1941, Guy Liddell, the head of B section, took on a new personal assistant. He was tall, thin, good-looking, and homosexual. A brilliant art historian and a linguist with all the right social connections. His name was Anthony Blunt, and he was a Soviet spy. 4 years earlier, Blunt, a secret and dedicated communist, had been recruited into the NKVD, later the KGB, by Dr. Arnold Deutsch, alias Otto, the cultured espionage talent spotter responsible for forging the so-called Cambridge spy ring. At the urging of his Soviet handlers, Blunt had applied to join the intelligence services, and by 1941 he was at the very heart of Britain's secret war machinery. Liddell had little need of an assistant, since he always does all the work again himself, and Blunt soon moved on to other work within the section. He had a finger in many of the most secret pies, working on German counter-espionage, running B-section surveillance unit, and intercepting the diplomatic bags of neutral countries. Languid, erudite, and whimsical, he cut a distinctive figure in the corridors of the St. James's building. He quoted Winnie the Pooh, sipping on a bottle of cod liver oil and malt, and remarking, "That's what Tigger's like for breakfast," and liked to play leapfrog in the canteen. Despite his charm, Blunt was not universally liked, although much of the animus was coloured by hindsight. "He was a very nice and civilized man," recalled Dick White, Liddell's deputy, "and he betrayed us all." Tar Robertson disliked Blunt intensely, but his attitude sprang not from any doubt about his loyalty, but from a homophobia common to the time. "I couldn't stick the man. One knew that he was queer, and before the war one would not have countenanced letting him anywhere near the office." Tar's distaste for Blunt's homosexuality did not stop him from discussing the most secret aspects of his work with him. In the public school parlance of the time, a gay man was said to be batting for the other side. But Blunt was batting for the other side in a way that no one inside MI5 could possibly have imagined, and making a remarkable score. Blunt first began passing secret information to his Soviet handler, Anatoly Gorsky, in January 1941, when the USSR and Germany were linked under the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. Passing military information to a power in alliance with Britain's enemy was an act of treason. Blunt would continue to feed secrets to Moscow in vast volume for the rest of the war. The Soviets gave him the codename Tony, the only example of a wartime codename that was actually an agent's real name, either a clever double bluff or amazingly stupid. Blunt met his handler once a week to hand over documents, both originals and copies. He memorized vast amounts of material, consulted the MI5 archive to answer Moscow's special requests, and spent his lunch hour rummaging through the desks of colleagues. He passed on personal files, operational information, intelligence summaries, Bletchley Park intercepts, diplomatic wireless traffic, and details of MI5 tradecraft, including bugs, surveillance, and interrogation techniques. Seldom has an intelligence organization been so comprehensively penetrated. Tony is a thorough, conscientious, efficient agent, his Russian handler reported to Moscow. He tries to fulfill all of our tasks in time and as conscientiously as possible. Britain and the Soviet Union would become allies against Hitler, but Blunt's torrential leakage of information to Moscow still represented the single gravest threat to the double-cross operation. If Soviet intelligence was penetrated by the Germans, then the information he was passing to Moscow would end up in Berlin. Over the next 4 years, Blunt would hand the Soviets a staggering total of 1,771 documents. But not for an instant did the double-cross team suspect the double agent in their midst. 6. Garbo takes the stage. In the winter of 1941, the Bletchley Park team decoding Abwehr wireless traffic between Madrid and Berlin made a most alarming discovery. Tar Robertson's fears, it seemed, were justified. The Germans did indeed have an agent active in Britain, writing secret missives to a controller in Madrid. His codename was Agent Arabel. He seemed to be well-informed, energetic, and resourceful, and had recruited at least 2 sub-agents. Most secret sources revealed that Berlin was delighted with his work. The implications were potentially catastrophic. This mysterious Arabel was in a position to contradict information supplied by the double-cross agents, in which case the duplicity of all MI5's double agents might be revealed. An uncontrolled agent, particularly one as good as this, could not only unravel the network in Britain, but expose the agents, most notably Popov, to mortal danger. Who was this Arabel, and how had he got into the country? Where had he sprung from? Where was he getting all this information from? The task of analysing intercepted traffic for counter-espionage purposes fell to the B1B section of MI5, known as Special Research, and headed by Herbert Lionel Adolphus Hart, a young Jewish lawyer who would go on to become a professor of jurisprudence at Oxford. The more H.L.A. Hart and his team pored over the Arabel traffic, the stranger it appeared. His fabulously drawn-out messages appeared to be written by someone suffering from chronic verbal incontinence. But more than that, the information supplied by Arabel was frequently, and sometimes hilariously, wrong. Arabel reported, for example, that the people of Liverpool indulged in drunken orgies and slack models at amusement centres. He appeared to believe that the summer heat was so intense in London that the diplomatic corps decamped en masse to Brighton for the summer months. He reported major naval manoeuvres on Lake Windermere, which is landlocked, involving an American-made amphibious tank, which had not been invented. He provided details of unreal army regiments and even provoked the enemy into attempting to intercept a convoy, sailing from Malta, that did not exist. Arabel was submitting meticulous monthly expenses to Berlin, but in a most curious form. He claimed, for example, to have visited Glasgow by train, at a cost of 87 shillings and 10 pence. This should have been rendered as £4, 7 shillings and 10 pence. Britain's pre-decimal currency was confusing, but not so baffling that someone living in the country would not have grasped it after 9 months. Such errors escaped the notice of the Abwehr, but the very wild messages being relayed through Madrid presented MI5 with a peculiar riddle. This rogue spy was eccentric and innumerate, or a fraud, or mad. In Lisbon, former chicken farmer Juan Puyol, invulnerable to rejection, had continued to pester the British to recruit him. Despite producing evidence to show he was now in the employ of the Germans, he was repeatedly turned down. His wife, Araceli, his accomplice from the start, took up the cause and approached the American naval attaché in Lisbon, who contacted his opposite number in the British Embassy, who duly, but very slowly, sent a report to London. Finally, MI6 twigged that the German agent sending the bogus messages must be Juan Puyol Garcia, the Spaniard who had repeatedly approached them in Lisbon. In the ancient British tradition of pointless interdepartmental rivalry, MI6, responsible for intelligence overseas, still did not inform MI5, responsible for counter-espionage in the UK, of Puyol's existence. Only a chance conversation between Tar Robertson and an MI6 officer from Lisbon alerted B1A to what was going on. Even then, MI6 was unwilling to allow Puyol to join the double-cross team. "I do not see why I should get agents and have them pinched by you," was, according to Guy Little, the attitude taken by MI6's head of counterintelligence. "The whole thing is so narrow and petty that it really makes me quite furious," wrote Little. A walk-in, in spy jargon, is an informant or agent who, without prompting, contacts an intelligence organization with an offer of information. Puyol had walked in to the British time after time, and then, when told he was not wanted, walked out again. Forced to rely on secondary sources and a first-rate imagination, he was in constant danger of exposure. His guidebook, for example, compared Brighton to the Spanish town of San Sebastian. Since diplomats escaped the summer heat of Madrid by moving to San Sebastian, Puyol logically, and wrongly, assumed that the same must be true of Brighton. It was, MI5 observed, a miracle that he had survived so long. The squabble over control of Puyol was finally won by Tar Robertson, who was delighted by this inventive new addition to his team. The Catalan was smuggled out of Lisbon on a steamer to Gibraltar, and then flown by military aircraft to Plymouth, arriving on April 24, 1942. After 2 weeks of interrogation, MI5 declared that, despite his inexhaustibly fertile imagination, he was telling the truth. The 20 committee initially wondered whether he might be a plant, but evidence from most secret sources, which MI6 now reluctantly agreed to share in full with the double-cross team, proved the truth of his story beyond doubt. Puyol's wife and young son were brought out of Lisbon, and the family was reunited in a safe house at 35 Crespigny Road, Hendon, in the North London suburbs. Puyol was provided with a housekeeper and a cover job, translating for the BBC. Most important, he acquired a case officer. Once again, Tar's choice was inspired. Tomás Tommy Harris was a 34-year-old half-Spanish artist whose imagination was as vivid as Puyol's, but tempered by solid common sense. The son of a rich Mayfair art dealer, Harris moved in bohemian circles and was friendly with the trio of Soviet moles, Kim Philby, Anthony Blunt, and Guy Burgess, an association that would later lead to the baseless claim that he too had been a double agent. Of all those recruited to run double agents, Masterman considered Harris to be, in some ways, the most remarkable. One colleague described him thus, with fierce black eyes and a hawk-like nose, thick, well-oiled hair slicked back from a low forehead, he looked like a casting director's ideal choice for a desert sheik or a slinky tango lizard. Harris and Puyol made an extraordinary double act. They spoke the same language, literally and metaphorically, and in time the combination of Harris's artistry and Puyol's flamboyant ingenuity would spin a web of deception that is as close to a thing of beauty as espionage can offer. Puyol's lexophilia had led him into spying. Over the next 3 years, he and Harris would bombard the Germans with hundreds of thousands of words, 315 letters in secret ink, and more than 1,200 wireless messages. Puyol would clock up an innings like no other double agent. He played his game with masterly skill, wrote Masterman, who dubbed him the Bradman of the Double Cross team, after the Australian cricketer Donald Bradman, the greatest batsman of all time. MI6 had given Puyol the codename Bovril, after the thick, salty meat extract that, like Marmite, appeals only to British palates, and only to some of those. It was possibly intended as a compliment, since Bovril was seen as a war food that had sustained soldiers in the trenches during the previous war. MI5 changed his codename, partly to make a point to MI6, and partly because, after his dramatic work of subterfuge in Lisbon, he deserved something grander, more befitting the best actor in the world of spying. Juan Puyol Garcia became Agent Garbo. Where Garbo had been secretly smuggled to London from Lisbon, Tricycle openly shuttled back and forth between the two capitals, ostensibly as director of Tarlair Limited, but in reality building up his credentials with both his German and British spymasters. The British authorities furnished the necessary paperwork for his mysterious business deals, while noting, "We are going in very deep with Popov." Seats on civilian flights between Lisbon and London were in hot demand, but space was always made for Popov, creating another source of concern. In time of war, only diplomats, journalists, and spies can travel about freely, and everyone knows Tricycle does not come into the first two categories. Popov was confident von Karstorff suspected nothing, but Luke was not so sure. The Germans may know he is doubling, but may consider that they get more information by letting him continue doing so than they would if he disappeared. I am not suggesting that Tricycle is aware that they know he is doubling. Dushko Popov might be an unwitting pawn in a clever German bluff. From Lisbon, Popov kept MI5 fully updated on his love life, which now incorporated Maria Alera, the 22-year-old Brazilian journalist whose home in Lisbon had been supplied by von Karstorff as the cover address for sending secret letters. Popov sent back photographs of Maria posing in sultry fashion on the steps of an airplane. In his file, these are labelled his latest girlfriend. But he did not neglect Gwenny. "Missing you terribly, darling. I adore you. Hope to be back soon." Was it possible, MI5 wondered, that someone so pathologically faithless in his romantic life could be loyal to one cause? By the summer of 1941, Popov had passed over to the Germans vast swaths of information, some of it true, none of it harmful, and much of it merely confusing. He described various new military inventions, a new anti-gas battle dress that the troops hated because of the smell, a silent aircraft engine, a high-velocity ammunition for machine guns, and an incendiary bomb made from a derivative of tar. His reports were garnished with snippets of political gossip, such as the news that Oswald Mosley, the interned British fascist, was degenerating in prison and has lost his personality. Popov's sub-agent, Dickie Metcalf, also began passing information, distinctly flavoured with the personality of a former soldier. The British infantry, Balloon reported, had been issued a new 7-inch bayonet, which makes for much easier withdrawal from Huns. MI6 was appalled by this joke. I wonder whether Balloon realizes he is working for the Germans. The double-cross traffic sent to Germany was growing more sophisticated as the 20 Committee served up an increasingly potent cocktail of information and deception, mixing falsehood, half-truth, and real, verifiable information approved by the relevant military authority. Gisela Ashley analyzed incoming messages, and Tarr began submitting to her all the traffic in its original German as a matter of routine. It was she who first argued that the double agent should be used not just to deceive individual spymasters, but to influence German thinking. "We are the double cross section in that we send over to the Germans information which is either misleading or which we want them to have. It seems to me there is a much wider scope for such a section. Would it not be possible to push across propaganda? Or to give the Germans ideas that we want them to have?" The men of Double Cross tended to think exclusively in military terms, but Gisela suggested that they paint a misleading picture of Britain itself by exaggerating anti-Jewish feeling, domestic fascism, and industrial unrest. After all, any decent spy would naturally try to get over warnings and pointers with regard to domestic news in the country in which he is spying. Popov was supposed to be gathering his information from senior figures in the British establishment, so to fortify his cover story, he was introduced to some. Victor Cavendish Bentinck, chairman of the Joint Intelligence Committee, met the young spy and wrote up his impressions. "He is by temperament an adventurer who is very partial to the fleshpots of this world, and he realizes that a person of his type can enjoy the fleshpots better under democratic than totalitarian conditions." There was some truth in this cynical assessment, but Popov was more than a mere sybarite. In lieu of payment, he hinted that he would like to be made British consul in Dubrovnik after the war, and receive some sort of decoration for his services. For all his insouciance, he was playing a deadly game, particularly after the German occupation of Yugoslavia from April 1941 left his family under direct Nazi threat. The Germans had reassured him that his relatives would be protected. "I do not like this protection much," he told Tar. "My own life is much less important to me than that of my family." Brave, self-indulgent, committed, venal and unfaithful, Popov was a man of the strangest honour. "I am still satisfied that he is playing straight with us," Luke reported to the 20 committee. When in Lisbon, Popov stayed at the Palacio Hotel, gambled in the Estoril casinos, and squared one woman or another around town, often in the company of his spymaster and friend, whom he was comprehensively betraying. Ludovico von Karstorff took his duties lightly and his pleasure seriously, and professed himself extremely pleased with the information provided. Von Karstorff rarely rose before midday, and spent much of his time in the gardens of Villa Tokiana, playing with his pet monkey, Simon, and his twin dachshunds, Ivan and Ivan. He had found in Popov, he believed, a man as self-indulgent as himself, who could improve his standing in the Abwehr and perhaps make him some money on the side. One evening, over cognac, he announced that Berlin wanted Popov to go to America. German espionage operations in the United States were a mess. The FBI was picking up German spies like whores on the Reeperbahn. Popov should go to New York and build a spy network from scratch, just as he had done in London. That way, when the Americans finally entered the war, Germany would be ready. Popov would be paid a great deal of money. When Popov returned to London and reported this approach, Tar Robertson was initially resistant, arguing that he was too valuable to be spared. Tricycle was running smoothly, highly respected in Berlin and a means of direct personal contact with the enemy. But if he refused this mission, it might raise German suspicions. Popov himself was eager to go. He had never visited the United States, and New York sounded like his kind of town. If the FBI played its cards well, here was an opportunity to create an American version of Double Cross. Von Karstorff seemed most accommodating and unsuspicious, and Johnny Yepsen, his best friend and patron, could be relied on to watch his back. Whenever Popov returned to Lisbon, Johnny would come to meet him. Their friendship was as solid as ever, though neither could afford to be fully candid. To Popov's surprise, Yepsen revealed he had recently gotten married to Eleanor Botild Peterson, known as Lore, an actress and the leading lady at the Frankfurt Theatre, though he still maintained a mistress in Paris and another in Dublin. Yepsen seemed able to travel freely, but his activities, as both a businessman and a freelance spy, were deeply mysterious. He told Popov he had recently visited Finland, Sweden, Greece, Persia, and the coast of Italy to draw up a report on Italian defences for Japanese intelligence. Japan was not yet in the war, but Tokyo's secret interest in coastal defences would take on an ominous significance after Pearl Harbor. Yepsen was supposed to be recruiting spies, but he happily admitted that the enrolment of Popov was his only success to date in this business. He was clearly a figure of some importance within German intelligence. When the conversation shifted to one Professor Miller, a teacher and Nazi at Freiburg, whom they had both disliked, Johnny remarked, half casually, "I am not cruel enough, but now I am in a position to get rid of anyone I hate. If I want to get rid of that man, all I have to do is say that Professor Miller said this and that, and they will kill him at once, without question. Then he added, if there is anyone you particularly want to have set free, I might be able to arrange it. The situation in Germany was deteriorating, Jebsen reported. Aircraft production was down, food was becoming scarce, and even clothing was in short supply. The dapper Jebsen, still styling himself as Anthony Eden, was having trouble maintaining his wardrobe. I would be willing to pay £600 for a suit of English clothes, but you cannot get them, he complained. Even more intriguing was Jebsen's description of the infighting between factions within German intelligence, some of which were secretly opposed to Hitler. The turf war between the Abwehr and the SD, Sicherheitsdienst, the intelligence agency of the SS and the Nazi Party, was particularly venomous and getting worse. They are like cat and dog with each other, Johnny observed. This sort of information was intelligence gold dust, which made Jebsen's remarks either extraordinarily indiscreet or entirely calculating. He made no secret of his disdain for Hitler, and dropped hints that he had fallen afoul of some powerful people who disapproved of his louche lifestyle. Whenever I go to Germany, I can never be sure whether I will get out alive, he said. Jebsen seemed thinner and more ravaged than before. His limp was worse, and his teeth stained brown from the cigarettes he smoked in a never-ending stream. Jebsen had good cause to fear returning to Germany, though he did not yet divulge the real reason to Popov. The Gestapo was after him. More than a year earlier, he had been approached by one Heinz Jost, a high-ranking official in the SD, who said he had some forged British banknotes that he wished to exchange for dollars. Jebsen cautiously observed that the Reichsbank had advised it was contrary to international law to forge currency. There the matter rested for a while. When Jost reappeared with bundles of 5 and 10 pound notes, Jebsen was told, or chose to believe, that this was genuine British currency, seized in Paris. Through a contact named Avramides at the Bank of Greece in Switzerland, he began exchanging the notes for dollars, passing the bulk to Jost, and keeping a substantial commission for himself. Some senior Gestapo officers also began passing him British cash to exchange. For 9 months, the arrangement had proved most satisfactory, as larger and larger amounts passed through Jebsen's hands. Jebsen spent his profits on his wife, his mistresses, himself, and his favourite novelist, for some of the ill-gotten gains ended up in the hands of P.G. Woodhouse. The British writer had remained in France at the outbreak of war and was duly interned as an enemy alien in Upper Silesia. If this is Upper Silesia, one wonders what must Lower Silesia be like, he wrote. Released in June 1941, just before the age of 60, under the terms of the Geneva Convention, he was playing a game of cricket in camp when he heard he was to be freed, Woodhouse and his wife, Ethel, eventually took up residence in occupied Paris. But since the royalties from his books were blocked, they were extremely short of funds. Jebsen gave money to his old friend. After his release, Woodhouse made a series of whimsical and deeply foolish radio broadcasts through the German propaganda service, in the naive belief that he would be admired for keeping a stiff upper lip during his internment. Instead, he became a hate figure in Britain, accused of collaborating with the Germans. It can only be imagined what Woodhouse's critics would have said had they known that this comic genius was being bankrolled by a German spy through an illegal currency scam involving the Gestapo, the Nazi security service, and a fortune in forged British banknotes. The forgery fiddle worked well for 9 months, and then dramatically unraveled. A Swiss bank spotted the fakes, and Jebsen's Greek middleman refused to deal in them any more. Jebsen would later claim that he had honestly believed the notes were legal tender, and, when he found out about the counterfeiting, did all he could to stop it, by reporting the matter to his superiors. More likely, he had known all along that he was dealing in duds, and cut his losses when he discovered the fiddle had been found out. In the ensuing row, Heinz Jost was dismissed from his comfortable post in the SD's Foreign Intelligence Department and sent to the Eastern Front, where he was placed in command of Einsatzgruppe A, the death squad responsible for killing thousands of Jews. Jost was now Jebsen's sworn enemy, whose friends in the Nazi hierarchy were determined to take revenge on his behalf. Jebsen also had allies, most notably Canaris, the Abwehr chief. He confided to Popov that he had set up a crude form of insurance policy. "I know too much about the dirty things that happen. I have got papers in a bank abroad, and if the bank does not receive a cable from me on this or that day, they will send the papers to a publisher." Jebsen's anti-Nazi remarks and his willingness to discuss the most secret aspects of German intelligence could only mean one thing. Jebsen knew that Popov was working for British intelligence and that the secret information he was supplying so casually would be passed straight back to London, as indeed it was. Popov was convinced his old friend knew what he was up to, a conviction that was strengthened when Jebsen observed, "If you are caught by the British, you can tell them that I will come over to the British side and work in whatever way I can." Jebsen was no more a loyal Abwehr officer than Popov was a genuine German agent. Each was lying to the other, and both knew they were being lied to. Theirs was a curious dance of deception in which neither could afford to admit the truth. Popov again urged MI5 to approach Johnny Jebsen in a neutral country and recruit him. "He is very pro-British, and I think if he was sure he would be safe, he would come over here. At heart, he is anti-Nazi, and he is always in difficulties with his superiors owing to his extravagant habits." If Jebsen was smuggled to Britain, Popov urged, he would reveal everything he knew, and could then be placed in honorable retirement at some resort. Billy Luke was doubtful. "I am not at all sure we would gain very much by having him here, as he seems very much of the playboy type." MI6 was also unconvinced by Popov's character reference for his friend, and not as confident as he is that Jebsen is anti-Nazi. It would be better to keep an eye on Jebsen and wait to see what else he might reveal. Like all startups experiencing rapid expansion, a flood of new employees and increasing overhead, the double-cross operation faced cash flow problems. No double agent was cheap to run. Those with extravagant tastes, like Dushko Popov, were fantastically expensive. But the Abwehr's money problems were even more acute. MI5 had to ensure that the Abwehr found a way to pay its spies. Otherwise, it would soon stop believing in them, because if a spy continues to work without getting paid, then someone else must be paying him. The spies sent to Britain were always short of cash. The Abwehr attempted to get money to its agents in a variety of ways, including airdrops, but with little success. Knowing this, B1A had the double agents make ever more pressing demands for cash. Wolf Schmidt, Agent Tate, kept up a steady litany of complaint in what Masterman called his virile telegraphies. "I am beginning to think you are full of shit," he told his Hamburg controller when the latter failed to supply funds. "I shit on Germany and its whole fucking secret service." Tate was finally told to wait in Victoria Station, follow a Japanese man carrying a copy of the Times onto a double-decker bus, and then pick up the newspaper when he left it on the seat. The entire episode was covertly photographed by MI5. It yielded £200 in £1 notes, and the identity of a Japanese diplomat, Assistant Naval Attaché Mitenori Yoshi, who was working for German intelligence in violation of his country's neutrality. But leaving packets of cash on buses was no way to finance an entire spy ring. The Abwehr needed a better way to get money to its agents, and MI5 needed to find a way to help it do so. Only a mind as supple as that of Dushko Popov could have come up with Plan Midas, a way to manufacture gold. His sub-agents, Gertner and Metcalf, needed payment, but, as Popov explained to von Kastorf, if he entered Britain carrying large quantities of cash, this would certainly raise suspicions. Why not find a middleman in London who could plausibly pretend to be passing money to German agents in return for reimbursement by the Germans in another country? The Germans would be reassured that their agents were being properly paid at last, and MI5 could simply pocket the cash. The enemy, believing it was financing its own agents, would end up paying for the double agents. The chosen middleman was Eric Glass, a successful and wealthy Jewish theatrical agent. Glass would pretend to be fearful of German invasion, determined to save his skin and his fortune, and prepare to transfer funds to the United States by unscrupulous means. The Germans would be told that Glass was willing to hand over money to Wolf Schmidt, who could then finance other agents in Britain by leaving cash in prearranged places. The Germans would then reimburse Glass by transferring money to his New York bank account, which MI5 could then appropriate. Eric Glass was a flamboyant figure, half Austrian and half British. His delight in approaching a deal and his inventive sagacity in clinching it were a byword in theatre and film circles. The part offered by MI5 appealed to him, and a deal was struck. Plan Midas was put into action. Glass, however, had developed doubts. The more he thought about what he was involved in, the more terrified he became. What if the Germans discovered the plot? Would they try to kill him? In the best theatrical tradition, Glass grandly declared he could no longer play his part and wanted to leave the stage. In fact, he was no longer needed, as MI5 had direct access to the New York account set up in his name. The show could go on without him. But Glass knew enough about Plan Midas to jeopardize the project. Superintendent George Leonor of Special Branch, the police unit working with MI5, was deployed to put the frighteners on the theatrical agent, a job he seems to have carried out with ugly, anti-Semitic relish. "He was in a complete flat spin and scared nearly out of his life," Leonor reported, having told Glass to keep his mouth shut or face the consequences. "I said enough to let him feel that his life depended on that. He can be trusted not to tell anyone. This trust is based on the only thing that in this case really counts, sheer fright. Sorry to appear somewhat ruthless, but we are at war, and I see no reason why the fears of a little Jew should in any way deflect us from our path." Midas would prove to be one of the most profitable and least known operations of the war. On the German side, the plan was approved by the Abwehr senior financial officer, who authorized an initial transfer of £20,000, money that the Abwehr believed was being used to finance espionage operations in the UK, poured into a New York bank account in the name of Eric Glass, and from there directly into MI5's coffers. Popoff took a 10% cut. Von Kastorf also took a commission. The Germans were overjoyed. "Heartiest congratulations," read the message sent to Wolf Schmidt when he reported the first cash handover by Glass. "On no account spend all the money at once on drink. For that you can wait until we come. We consider ourselves invited." The double-cross system was now not only self-financing, but profitable, to Masterman's delight. The actual cash supplied by the Germans to maintain their and our system between 1940 and 1945 was something in the region of £85,000, the equivalent of more than £4.5 million today. 7. Popoff goes shopping. On a hot afternoon in August 1941, Dushko Popoff boarded a plane at Portela Airport in Lisbon, bound for the United States. He was carrying $70,000 in cash and a telegram on which were 11 microdots, barely visible to the naked eye, the latest in German espionage technology. Enlarged under a powerful microscope, these tiny specks would reveal themselves to be photographs of a new set of questionnaires drawn up by von Kastorf. Recruited to spy on the British, Popoff had spied on the Germans, and now, in yet another twist, he was being sent by the Germans to spy on the Americans with British approval. Popoff's mission for MI5 was to create an American counterpart to Double Cross by building up a network of fake double agents. MI5 had already sent the FBI a glowing character reference. "Popoff is a clever, attractive, and courageous young man of whose sincerity and loyalty we are satisfied. He has an excellent brain, but dislikes work. He is fond of women, and yachting is his principal pastime. He has personality and charm, and would be at home in society anywhere. He has refused payment from us of any kind, as he has received adequate payment from the German Secret Service, and we are hoping that this happy state of affairs will continue." Tar Robertson had been reluctant to see Popoff go west. "For the moment, we can spare you," he said, "but we shall probably ask you to come back in the not-too-distant future." Tar knew the opportunity to replicate the double-cross system stateside was too good to pass up. Popov's American mission should have been a triumph. It was an unmitigated disaster. The problem was partly cultural. The FBI, under the dictatorial and dynamic leadership of J. Edgar Hoover, took a very different approach to counter-espionage. The foreign spy, in Hoover's mind, was just another species of criminal to be caught, tried, and then executed with maximum publicity. The Bureau had achieved a breakthrough success in 1941 with the capture of no fewer than 33 German spies, using one of their number as bait in what Hoover proclaimed to be the greatest spy roundup in U.S. history. With time, the FBI would come to appreciate the value of double agents, but the immediate effect of that success was to convince Hoover that the only use for a captured spy was to capture more spies. As usual, MI5 reached for a cricket analogy. His first innings was too easy, and he imagined, apparently, that the Huns would not learn the lesson. The FBI was not equipped, psychologically or practically, to run double agents. "It's a great pity," wrote Masterman. Dushko Popov was exactly the sort of person Hoover loathed. Dissolute, extravagant, sexually voracious, and foreign. As Ewan Montague observed, Hoover obviously only regarded Tricycle as potential flypaper, useful to trap more pests, but rather disgusting to handle. Relations between Popov and his new FBI handlers started badly and grew steadily worse. The questionnaires in the microdots Popov had brought to the United States furnished an important insight into German thinking. Popov was instructed to set up a network to gather information on atomic energy, military preparations, convoys, industrial production, politics, and morale. In hindsight, the most crucial part of Popov's questionnaire asked for intelligence on Pearl Harbor, the Hawaiian naval base. Its anchorage is submarine port, floating docks, and mine defenses. Popov later claimed that he, and for that matter, Johnny Yebsen, had realized from the start that this questionnaire pointed to a looming Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. This is unlikely. There is nothing in Popov's file to indicate that he understood, let alone warned anyone about, the significance of the questions. 4 months after Popov's arrival, the Japanese attacked, catapulting America into war. Had the Allies missed a vital tip-off that might have changed history? Certainly some in MI5 believed so, and blamed the FBI for failing to spot the clues. The mistake we made was not to take the Pearl Harbor information and send it separately to Roosevelt, Tar Robertson said many years later. No one ever dreamed Hoover would be such a bloody fool. Masterman was similarly critical. The questionnaire indicated very clearly that in the event of the United States being at war, Pearl Harbor would be the first point to be attacked, and that plans for this attack had reached an advanced stage by August 1941. Actually, the questionnaire showed no such thing. It did not indicate that an air assault was planned, and still less that a Japanese attack was imminent. It merely demonstrated that the Germans were acutely interested in Pearl Harbor, which, given that the U.S. Pacific Fleet was based there, was hardly surprising. The simple truth is that no one, neither Popov, nor Yebsen, nor MI5, nor the FBI, saw the questionnaire as a harbinger of the attack on Pearl Harbor until after it happened. Popov expected to be welcomed by the FBI, just as MI5 had embraced him, but in place of Tar's clubby congeniality, he found only deep suspicion. From the moment he checked into the Waldorf Astoria, Popov was put under surveillance, which the FBI's G-men made little effort to disguise. Under FBI control, he began sending secret letters back to von Karstorff in Lisbon, but the U.S. military authorities declined to provide any genuine information to put in these. He was told he could not visit Hawaii to investigate the defenses there. Popov had been instructed to establish a radio link with Lisbon and Rio de Janeiro, home to an active Abwehr spy cell. But when the FBI did finally establish a radio transmitter based on the north shore of Long Island, Popov was not permitted to know what information was being sent in his name. The FBI did not go in for jocular code names. Popov was Confidential Informant ND63, an austere title that aptly reflects the Bureau's chilly attitude. Held at arm's length by the FBI and prevented from conducting any active espionage, Popoff went on a spending binge of epic proportions. Hoover was already worried that the spy's playboy habits could embarrass the Bureau, and the scale of his expenses seemed calculated to do just that. Within a short time, he had acquired an apartment on Park Avenue, a summer house in fashionable Locust Valley on Long Island, a red Buick convertible, and another girlfriend, the French film star Simone Simon, whom he had met before the war. When challenged over his wild expenditure, Popoff blandly insisted that he needed to maintain his cover as a wealthy roué. Among the accoutrements he considered necessary for this purpose were a butler called Brooks, a half-deaf Chinese manservant called Chen Yen, and a team of gardeners. He had his apartment refurbished by an interior designer and spent $12,000 on furniture, antiques, and several hundred gramophone records. He drank and danced at the Stork Club, skied in Sun Valley, Idaho, and motored south for a sunny vacation in Florida. He also began an affair with an expensive Englishwoman, soon to be divorced, named Terry Richardson, and set off a fresh spasm of disapproval within the FBI when he took her on holiday, since transporting a woman across state lines for immoral purposes was illegal under the Ludicrous Man Act. The FBI suspected Mrs. Richardson might be a German spy, but finally concluded she was merely a gold digger. Popoff's gold supplies, however, were dwindling. He had kept half the money brought from Lisbon, but swiftly spent it. The Abwehr handed over another $10,000, and he spent that too. When the Germans failed to send more money, he demanded a loan from the FBI in order to pay his tailor, shirtmaker, florist, and staff. Popoff treated the FBI as his private bank, and although the Bureau, with extreme reluctance, began to subsidize his high living, relations deteriorated still further. Popoff's Plan Midas was bringing in a steady stream of cash, but even MI5 expressed astonishment at Popoff's spending. "His financial behavior in the U.S. cannot be justified," wrote John Marriott, noting that Popoff was burning through more than $5,000 a month. "I cannot distinguish his handling of this money from embezzlement." The man with the tricky job of reining in Popoff's profligacy was Colonel Walter Freckles Wren of MI6. "Tricycle should have a good talking to," he was told, "so that he should adjust his expenditure to a more reasonable basis." It was a vain hope. Popoff was living a Gatsby-esque life, but he was far from happy. Ewan Montague, on a visit to the United States to solidify intelligence relations between the Allies, found him depressed and worried, with all the gaiety which exudes from him completely gone. Popoff's family was in Yugoslavia, under Nazi rule, and by handling him so ineptly and undermining his credibility with the Germans, the FBI was placing them in extreme danger. Hoover's management of Tricycle could not have been more calculated to blow him if Hoover had sat down to devise and plan a method of doing so, said Montague, who tried to lift Popoff's spirits by telling him that there were people who still believed in him, that we were ready to go to real trouble to keep him alive as a double agent and continue the work against the Nazis for which he had risked his life. Popoff's fear that the Germans would lose faith in him was fully justified. In March 1942, Bletchley Park deciphered an Abwehr message revealing just how far Popoff had fallen in German estimation. Berlin suspected Tricycle to be working for both sides and recommended extreme caution when dealing with him. Popoff was not told of the Germans' suspicions. Intriguingly, the intercepts also showed that a larger sum in dollars ought to have been paid to him in the United States, but his handlers in Lisbon had not passed it on. Von Karsthoff and Johnny Jebsen, it seemed, were skimming off funds intended for Popoff. His spymaster and friends were using him to rip off their own bosses. By the summer of 1942, Popoff and the FBI had had enough of each other. "I cannot continue under this strain," Popoff wrote. The Bureau had even begun interfering in his love life, the ultimate offense, by intercepting his telegrams to Simone Simon. Tricycle suspects the evil hand of the FBI in everything, MI5 noted. He wanted out, and the FBI wanted him out. By July, he had racked up a debt to the FBI of $17,500, and the Bureau declared it was no longer prepared to maintain him in his present state of living. The Germans also failed to send any more money, despite Popov's urgent appeals, yet another indication of their waning confidence. An internal FBI report stated, Popov has been totally unproductive so far as developing any German espionage or other subversive activities in the United States is concerned, and has been a continuous source of annoyance in connection with his lavish expenditures. It is therefore recommended that he be turned back to the British for use by them in London. Tar Robertson was only too happy to bring Tricycle back into the fold, but reintegrating him into the double-cross system would be tricky. The Germans were mistrustful, and Popov would face an uphill task in regaining their trust. If he failed to do so, then his sub-agents, and all the other connected double agents being paid through Plan Midas, would fall under suspicion. I need not repeat the importance to us of preserving the German's faith in Tricycle because of his link-up with other B1A agents, wrote Tar. A choice was put to Popov. He could end his double agent work with our gratitude, or he could come back via Lisbon and try to explain away his failure in America and rehabilitate himself with his Abwehr masters. He chose to go back to Lisbon. There was still the matter of Popov's debts. MI5 calculated he had managed to spend $86,000 in just 9 months, including $26,000 on entertaining, social life, etc. Ian David Wilson, the 38-year-old London solicitor who had taken over from Billy Luke as Popov's case officer, was sent to New York to try to extricate him from the mess and prepare Popov for what was likely to be his toughest test so far. Wilson was an intriguing figure. With prominent ears, an awkward manner, and a razor-keen mind, he was fiercely conventional and set in his ways. He worked in the same law firm all his life, never moved house, and avoided all forms of small talk. Quiet and introverted, he contributed very little to conversations. Yet he had a truly remarkable capacity for concentration and absorbing detail. He completed the Times crossword every morning in a few minutes, never missing a clue. Happiest immersed in minutiae, he memorized every aspect of the case. He lived through Popov. Wilson needed to find out what information Popov was supposed to have sent to the Germans and explain where he had gotten it. He would also need an explanation for his lack of productivity in the United States and some juicy new intelligence to convince von Kastorf that he was still to be trusted. All of this required American cooperation, but the FBI, in Wilson's words, failed to produce any worthwhile information for Tricycle to take with him. So Wilson and Popov simply invented a slew of American informants to explain how he had come into possession of certain information in the USA. These fake informants were real people, including a Russian journalist named Igor Cassini, as well as Sol Bloom, a very pro-British congressman and chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, who had never exchanged a word with Popov. Hoover was outraged and denounced the subterfuge as extremely objectionable. Wilson compiled a caustic report on the American handling of the case. The FBI have lost all interest in Tricycle. The FBI were either through incompetence, lack of power, lack of interest, or lack of goodwill, of no assistance, and let us down badly. Popov's debts to the Bureau should be paid off, he recommended, to prevent any further deterioration in relations, in spite of the fact that the FBI have handled the case in such a way that they do not deserve to be repaid. Tar Robertson read Ian Wilson's tirade with relish. It is a very outspoken document, but I do not see any object in mincing matters with such an organization as the FBI. Now that Popov was back on the double-cross team, his old ebullience returned. After weeks of coaching by Wilson and Wren, he felt sure he could tell von Kastorf a convincing tale. But Wilson was anxious. To repurchase German confidence, Popov would have to describe information he had never obtained from people he had never met. Tricycle himself showed great confidence in his ability to survive his meetings in Lisbon. His story is thin and cannot expect to survive searching interrogation, but he is satisfied that his personal relations with Johnny Yebsen and von Kastorf will pull him through. Thrusting Popov back into suspicious German hands after the American debacle was Robertson's biggest gamble so far, and he knew it. His chances were nothing like even money. The odds must be at least 2-1 that he was blown, and, if he was, it was pretty certain that he would be tortured to squeeze him dry of information about our system, and there was an equally probable death sentence awaiting him at the end. Dushko Popov flew from New York on October 12, 1942, leaving behind an enormous number of gramophone records, a number of broken hearts, and a stack of bills that would follow him unpaid for the rest of the war. Montague thought Tricycle's decision to return to Lisbon was the greatest instance of cold-blooded courage that I have ever been in contact with. Before leaving New York, Popov had sent a telegram alerting von Kastorf that he would be arriving in Lisbon on October 14, 1942. Will telephone office on arrival. Hope Johnny will be waiting for me. Instead, he was welcomed back to Portugal by a smiling von Kastorf, along with a clean-shaven, dark-haired man Popov had never met before, who gave his name as Kammler. Popov described this new officer, a lieutenant, as about 28 years old, stiff in manner, and speaking English as if he learned it from a book. His real name was Otto Kurer, an officer in the Abwehr Espionage Division. He was there to take part in the debriefing of the prodigal agent. Their manner was friendly but businesslike, and Popov could sense he was being regarded with some suspicion. Settled in the large salon of a comfortable apartment on the Avenida de Berna, von Kastorf came straight to the point and presented Popov with what sounded oddly like a school report card. His work in England, before leaving for the United States, had been very good. In America it had initially been excellent, then medium, and then, for the last 3 months, terribly bad. Von Kastorf eyed him keenly. Now you know what Berlin thinks of you. Popov responded by telling von Kastorf what he thought of Berlin. He delivered a furious broadside against the Abwehr for sending him to the United States, undersupported and underfunded. He was now deeply in debt, he said, and it was all the fault of his German handlers. You send me there with no help whatsoever, no contacts, a few miserable dollars, and you expect me to produce results in no time. It was a bravura performance, and put von Kastorf on the defensive. We did all we could. It was Berlin's fault. The Abwehr man seemed uninterested in the meagre haul of intelligence Popov had brought back from the United States. He did not try to pick holes in his story. He did not even discuss the little intelligence he had sent. Von Kastorf, it seemed, was not only willing to believe Popov's story, but unwilling to ask him anything that might make it harder to do so. The reasons for his eagerness were personal, professional, and financial. Popov had long assumed that his German handlers were skimming off money that should have been passed to him. Kammler observed darkly that Popov had not received adequate funds in the United States because Yebsen had embezzled at least $10,000. They were all making money, illicitly, from Popov's spy salary. Von Kastorf, Yebsen, and even, it seemed, this man Kammler. Berlin are stupid fellows, Kammler remarked. They are sitting at desks and don't realize the difficulties of being without money. Please work hard in the future, or we shall all have trouble here, and you'll see we will be able to give you big bonuses. Popov had become more than a spy in the eyes of his German handlers. He was a valuable business, and thus in a powerful bargaining position, since von Kastorf and Kammler were clearly terrified that he might make a scene with Berlin. He now demanded full payment of all the money he claimed to be owed. The financial wrangling continued for days, but Popov had the upper hand. Kammler begged him not to make difficulties over money arrangements, because such difficulties might cause Kammler to be removed from Lisbon and sent to the Russian front. If Popov continued as before, they would all make money, and Berlin would be pleased. If he did not, then they were all in deep trouble. They could not afford for him to fail. He had absolute faith in his own powers of persuasion and seduction, and rightly so. For 3 days later, London intercepted a message sent by von Kerstorff to Berlin, in which he reported that Popov had been subjected to severe interrogation, and no evidence had been found that he was engaging in double work. Popov was in the clear. Lisbon seemed to have satisfied themselves that Tricycle was not double-crossing them, Tarr reported. Popov spent a week in Lisbon arguing over money, until a deal was finally struck. The Germans would pay him $25,000, plus 6,000 Portuguese escudos, and a salary of $2,500 a month, depending on his performance. From Popov's standpoint, this was a remarkable bargain, a lump sum to repay debts he had not incurred for services to the Third Reich he had not rendered, and a future stipend to continue betraying the Germans and supplying information that was either useless or false. The origin of the money and Jebsen's role in the deal were unclear, but Popov's old friend was somewhere in the background, pulling strings and lining his pockets. Following the script laid out by Wilson, Popov declared that he intended to return to London and continue spying as before. "Berlin wants information of direct use for military purposes," von Kerstorff told Popov. Reports on public morale, industrial output, and political gossip were all very well, but we are not so interested in people's feelings, not in production, but interested in purely military facts. Specifically, Berlin wanted advance warning of Allied military plans. Now that America had entered the war, there would surely be a counterattack to try to roll back the German occupation in North Africa, France, Norway, or somewhere else. "What about invasion?" von Kerstorff demanded. "Where will it be? See what kind of training and instruction the army has. Are they learning any languages? What kind of beaches are they training on?" Popov should furnish as much information on military preparations as possible, and the Germans would make their own deductions. Popov landed back in Britain with his new mission, $25,000 in cash in his pocket, and 5 matches impregnated with a new type of secret ink, sewn into the shoulder pads of his overcoat. A room was waiting for him in Claridge's hotel, but Tar Robertson asked Jock Horsfall, the MI5 chauffeur, to drive Popov directly from the airport to Robertson's own house in West London, so that I can satisfy my curiosity, and at the same time welcome him home. Popov seemed voluble and rather confused, expressing a great deal of vague feelings of grievance with regard to his American visit. But there was no doubt whose side he was on. "He is entirely friendly towards us, and I have no doubt about his loyalty." At a debriefing session the next morning, attended by Robertson, Masterman, and Wilson, Popov searched through his pockets for the cash given to him by von Kerstorff, finally located the wads in his trench coat pocket, and dumped it all on the table. Masterman was stunned at his extraordinary casualness about money, and observed, "It is quite probable that he would have lost or been robbed of this large sum of money without worrying very much about it." Popov explained, without rancor, that his German handlers were embezzling, both by making profit on exchange and taking a considerable rake off from money from Berlin. He seemed to regard this as normal business practice. "I was cheated by Johnny, I was cheated by von Kerstorff," he said. "I think Kammler earned a lot of money from the exchange." Once again he urged MI5 to recruit Jebsen, whom he described as very anti-Nazi. If properly handled, Johnny would give him a great deal of information. He was adamant that any German doubts about his loyalty had been dispelled. "Any suspicion against me was cleared up on the first day." Popov's best defense was the sheer force of his personality, Tarr reflected. His uncanny ability to impose himself and his views on the Germans when personal contact could be made. Von Kerstorff was not in any way suspicious, and had promised to send a letter to the Savoy Hotel with 3 microdots containing questionnaires for Popov's new mission. The MI5 team was deeply relieved. "Von Kerstorff has defended Tricycle as his agent and made a good deal out of the business. Here were fine opportunities for blackmail and manipulation. But it was the German hunger for information about Allied invasion plans that set Tarr thinking. Von Kerstorff wanted raw military intelligence as much as possible and urgently. "We may be able to draw our own conclusions," he had told Popov. It was a revealing observation, for it suggested that, with careful planning, the Germans might be guided into drawing not their own conclusions, but the conclusions the double-cross team wanted them to draw. 8. The Great Game. Roman Chernavsky met Hugo Bleicher, his German handler, in the lavatory of the Brasserie Georges in Lyon on August 15, 1942. In the intervening weeks, the Polish spy had learned how to construct a wireless transmitter, memorized his code, and consumed food in enormous quantities at a Chinese restaurant next door to the safe house on Rue de Fresnoy, rebuilding his strength after months in prison. Concealed in the heels of his shoes were two transmitting crystals. Chernavsky had slipped across the border into Vichy, France, and made contact, as instructed by Colonel Oskar Reiler, with Polish intelligence, explaining that he had escaped and now needed to get to Britain, quickly. He revealed nothing about his deal with the colonel. The Polish Secret Service contacted MI6 and plans to evacuate the leader of the defunct Interallié network, who had miraculously evaded the clutches of the Germans, were set in motion. He would be smuggled into neutral Spain using the underground route for escaping POWs, and then put on the next flight to Britain. Bleicher had been shadowing him, and thoroughly enjoying his free holiday in southern France. He even brought along one of his French mistresses. The meeting in the Brasserie Georges was the first time they had met since Roman Chernavsky's escape. Their conversation in the restaurant lavatory was brief and quite odd. With some embarrassment, Bleicher said that although he realized that any manifestation of mistrust on their part would jeopardize the affair, German bureaucratic rules required a written guarantee of Chernavsky's loyalty. This was a mere formality. Bleicher then handed over a piece of paper that stated, in German, that Chernavsky was starting to work for the National Socialist State in a military capacity, and undertaking his mission voluntarily, and if he failed in his duty, the Germans would be entitled to take reprisals. Here was a bold threat, disguised as form-filling, a guarantee that if he reneged on his promises, then the people he loved would be killed. Only a state as murderous and bureaucratic as the Third Reich would require a man to sign his own family's death warrant and consider it binding. Chernavsky signed. The next day, Bleicher picked up a letter at the Hôtel d'Orléans. It read, "Long live Hitler, the great builder of a new Europe." Chernavsky was on his way to Britain. In London, Roman Chernavsky was greeted by the Polish community as a returning hero, a patriotic superspy who had defied the Germans in occupied Paris and then, astonishingly, managed to slip out of their grasp. During October 1942, he was interviewed by both British and Polish intelligence officers and subjected to the most exhaustive and painstaking interrogation. No one smelled a rat. The Polish pilot was praised for his great daring and initiative in forging the Interallié network. "He is a natural leader of men and has great organizing ability," MI5 noted. Colonel Stanislav Gano of Polish intelligence, who had met Chernavsky in London the year before, welcomed him back with open arms. The story of his flight from German custody was amazing, and everyone was prepared to accept it as genuine. Or almost everyone. Some found Chernavsky's account a little too heroic to be credible. A rumor began to circulate that there was something funny about his escape. Chernavsky was not the only member of the French network to reappear in Britain. Monique Deschamps, Moustique, the tiny, vivacious and attractive head of the Interallié's southern sector, had also escaped the Gestapo and made her way across the Channel. So too had Mathilde Carré. Like Chernavsky, she had agreed to work for the Germans as a double agent in Britain. Under Bleicher's instruction, she had used the captured Interallié wireless to maintain the fiction that she had escaped the roundup and was continuing her work as an Allied agent. In the spring of 1942, Bleicher had her send a message to London, asking to be evacuated, as she feared she was about to be arrested. The British agreed to send a boat to collect her from the French coast. The plan was that in London, I should get as many names as I could of agents working in France for the Allies. After that, the great roundup would take place. They promised me an enormous sum of money, a trip to Germany, and the publication of my memoirs in the largest Nazi newspaper. Mathilde was enthralled to her German lover. She promised to bring back for Bleicher a couple of pairs of shoes from a London bootmaker. Bleicher may have hated the British, but he was partial to handmade English shoes. Mathilde Carré was picked up by a fast British motor gunboat at Behy Point, near Lannion, on the Brittany coast, Bleicher having ensured that no German patrol would be on hand to interrupt the rendezvous. In London, she was interrogated by a uniformed British officer with impeccable manners and a steely look. "Anglo-Saxon hypocrisy is so often preferable to Gallic excitability," she later reflected. Once again, she broke almost immediately, confessing that she had been recruited as an Abwehr agent, but insisting that she had always intended to betray the Germans as soon as she was on British soil. She did not, however, explain her relationship with Hugo Bleicher, or her role in the breakup of the Interallié network. The British did not quite know what to make of Mathilde Carré. She was lodged in a safe house and kept under close surveillance. Tchernavsky's arrival in London sealed her fate. Mathilde had betrayed them all, he explained. Her guilt is the greater, since, although she must have fully realized the extent of the catastrophe, she helped the Germans in their work. Bleicher had doubtless put her under intense pressure, but there is no excuse whatever for treason and betrayal to the enemy of her colleagues, knowing that they will face the firing squad. Tchernavsky did not, of course, mention that he too had been recruited by German intelligence. Mathilde was arrested and lodged in Aylesbury Prison. She would spend the rest of the war behind bars. Tchernavsky, the decorated war hero, was given a desk job by the Polish government in exile. He moved into a flat in Brompton with Monique Deschamps, who became his lover. For the first time since the war began, Roman's life appeared to achieve a sort of calm. Then he dropped what MI5 called the bombshell. 6 weeks after arriving in Britain, Tchernavsky presented Colonel Stanislav Garno of Polish intelligence with a 64-page typewritten document, written in English and entitled The Great Game. It began, "The Germans are entering the final stage of losing the game. It has become my ambition to conclude this affair in grand style." Tchernavsky then proceeded to describe, in detail, his recruitment by the German Secret Service, the conversations in his jail cell at Fresnes, the deal struck with Bleicher and Reiler, the terms of his mission, and his faked escape from German custody. As proof, he produced the wireless crystals which he had kept hidden in the heels of his shoes. He had merely been playing a part, he said, carrying out a carefully worked out plan to fool the Germans. He insisted, "During the whole period of my collaboration with the Germans, they did not receive from me the slightest hint which might have helped them in combating our or Allied organizations on the continent." The double agent now offered to turn triple agent, pointing out that he was in a unique position to tell the German high command, via wireless, anything that Allied intelligence wanted to tell them. Tchernavsky laid down the rules of his game. "I shall discuss personally all data with the British, or rather with one Englishman, an officer who alone would hold the entirety of the affair in his hands and would be in charge of it. I would act as the expert." No one else in Polish intelligence should know the truth about how he had really gotten out of France. The story of my escape, for the good of the cause, must continue to be regarded as true. This extraordinary document ended with a characteristically grandiose flourish. "I am convinced that if an exact plan is laid down now, and carried out logically and adhered to strictly, then the great game has all the chances of success and may yield great results. If I have acted wrong in organizing the great game, the news that I have perished in an air accident will save my family and my colleagues." When Colonel Garno had finished reading, he looked up, staggered. But before he could speak, in a final dramatic gesture, Tchernavsky demanded a revolver to shoot himself if his request were refused, and he was found to have failed in his military duty. Garno's first reaction was shock, but his second was blind fury. Chernovsky had lied to his superior officers. He had deliberately concealed the true circumstances of his escape. He had struck a deal with the enemy and had continued to hide the truth for weeks after arriving in Britain. He had made Gano look a fool. Chernovsky responded that he had not revealed the truth until now, because he was not certain of the degree to which the Germans had penetrated Polish HQ in London. The suggestion that the Polish government in exile might harbour enemy spies made Gano even angrier. He ordered Chernovsky to return to his flat and await further orders, and declared his belief, from which he never wavered, that Chernovsky was a sinister individual who deserved to be shot.